You're listening to The Path with Brad Wetzler. This is episode 3 featuring Ross Winner.
All right. Here we are. This is The Path podcast, and I'm Brad Wetzler. How are you doing today? Hope you're doing all right out there. I woke up and just felt, looked at the calendar and realized it was, it's been a year since, we came inside and began wearing masks, began social distancing, began living these sort of lives that were more separated, and maybe for some more internal. So I'm wondering how you're doing on this sort of 1 year anniversary of this pandemic. I'm also wondering how you've changed. This podcast is about transformation. And the three questions that I'm most interested in are, what is transformation? How is it done? And how can we use our personal transformation, the inner work we do, to show up differently in the world, maybe to help people? How does all this work, this thing about inner work, transformation, spirituality, psychology, where does this all go? And how can we keep it from becoming too solipsistic or just about ourselves? I think that's a big question I'm interested in talking about too in this podcast as we go forward. I think for me, there was a period of really going inward and getting clear about who, what I am. And that's sort of a necessary phase. And actually, it's a lifelong phase. I don't think that phase ever ends. But then maybe as we discover who we are or begin to, we find more balance in our lives. We find practices, new mindsets that serve us, help us to be healthier human beings. I think we can start asking other questions about maybe what's our purpose in life. And I'm wondering if landing on purpose before we do that inner work is even possible or even a good idea. I'm thinking about, some of the people who become incredibly evangelistic and believing in their cause. I'm thinking now about the people that stormed the Capitol, for instance, on January 6th and are committed to a purpose, committed to what they think is their purpose, perhaps. But is it really their purpose? Is it really in alignment with who they are as people, or have they become imprisoned by their own ideas? And I guess I'm aware that, all of us can do that, that not only the people in who stormed the Capitol, they're really a metaphor, a way to look at this issue, because we can all get trapped in, who we think we are. And we can get over-identified with that, I think. And so purpose, that's what I want to talk about today. And what is purpose? How do we find it? How can we use it in our own transformation? What's authentic purpose? And I think I have the perfect guest today to go deep into this. His name is Ross Winner. And Ross is a educator and the leader, the director of the World Leadership School, as well as Teach United. Ross was a reporter in his more youthful years, in his 20s, and he found himself out of his purpose, I think. And this is what makes Ross, I think, an extraordinary person to talk to. And he found his purpose fairly quickly, I think, and unusually so. And so I want to talk to him today about his journey to find his own purpose. And then he became a leader and an educator about purpose and about helping others find their purpose. The World Leadership School and Teach United, both these foundations are dedicated to, you know, helping rural students connect more with their head, hearts, and hands. In fact, they work with students everywhere now and even adults. This idea of when we connect with our head, hearts, and hands, with our thinking, feeling, and doing, we find our purpose there at that intersection. And so I look forward to talking to Ross today, and I hope you're doing well out there. I'm glad you joined me for episode 3. So without further ado, I bring you Ross Wiener and our discussion about finding your purpose. Hey, Ross, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Brad.
I'm really grateful that you're here, and I'm excited to talk about transformation, education, and the link between the two. So I guess I wanted to start out asking you a little bit more to talk to your, to my listeners here about what it is you do. I know you're a leader in education. You run the World Leadership School. Kind of just fill the listeners in.
Yeah, sure. So over the last 15 years, I've built an organization called World Leadership School, which works with K through 12 schools all around the world to empower young leaders to find innovative solutions to the world's pressing problems. So we're all about building like the next generation of leaders. And we do global travel programs for schools, and we also help train coach teachers to bring purpose to learning. So it's all about sort of transforming schools through a lens of purpose.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to diving into all of that here in a bit. I'd like to start out with a story about personal transformation. I think it's always something that happens in our own lives that sets us on a path to do something good for the world. And tell me about a time when you realized you were on a path that wasn't right for you, and you corrected your course and changed in the process.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, a really big moment in my life was really when I graduated college. You know, I had been all my childhood, I was a stutterer. So I had a really hard time answering a phone or answering a question in class. I would just kind of get locked up. And I sort of spent, you know, all my high school and middle school years kind of scared, actually. But I was a really great student. I kept my head down and I got straight A's and I went off to a great university. And at the university, I continued to just keep my head down and work really hard. And I got, you know, straight A's, made the dean's list and did all these things. And when I graduated college, I went home and I went to my hometown in Northern Virginia. And I had been working in the summers as an intern at a newspaper. So I took a job as a newspaper reporter, which felt great. I was making a salary. I was able to buy a car and rent a place with my older brother. And life was really good. And then, you know, about a year into that experience, you know, I began realizing that I didn't really love my job. I was reporting on high technology companies inside the Beltway, and it just something about it was not like I was enjoying the skill building, but it wasn't hitting the inner meaningful part of me. And I remember waking up this one morning and just having this like pit of anxiety and dread in my stomach. And I realized that, you know, as the poet Rimbaud says, you know, my life is elsewhere. Like I just felt like I was living someone else's life. And over the next month or two, I really started thinking deeply about this. And I sort of had a sort of emotional crisis. You know, I went to see a therapist, and eventually I decided that I needed to quit my job and do something totally different. And so I went to speak to my parents, who are wonderful. who were always been so supportive. And I went to them and I said, you know, look, mom and dad, I've decided that I'm going to quit my job. And I've decided that I'm going to buy a plane ticket and move to South America and work as a freelance writer and cover the end of the Pinochet military government in Chile. That's the spot in the world that I want to be right now. That's the kind of news that I want to be reporting on. And there's this long pause. And my father, I remember my father looking at me and he goes, just shakes his head. He says, Ross, you're making a huge mistake. You know, you have worked so hard to get to this point. You are a straight A student at the university. Very few people of your age have a full-time job like yours. You just bought a brand new Jetta, Volkswagen Jetta. You know, why would you throw all this away? And, you know, if you just stick this job out, you know, in 5 years, you could be at the Washington Post. You know, you need to stay the course. And I heard my parents out, but ultimately I decided that I did want to take the risk and I did want to move to Chile. And I did, although I didn't speak Spanish, I didn't have a job. And it was kind of an unstable political situation that I was working in. But I will say that though that year in Chile was really lonely and sometimes dangerous, it was the moment that I really stepped into my story for the first time. And taking that road less traveled has made really all the difference. And it is clear now that was the beginning of a path that has led me to where I am today.
You know, one of the things that's most interesting about this story for me is A, how young you were, and B, how clear you became. Can you talk more about maybe first the feeling you had when you thought you were on the wrong path, when you felt you were on the wrong path, beyond just the sick feeling maybe, and then talk about how that clarity developed over the next year?
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting about it is that I think we get clarity in retrospect. Like looking back on it now, I can see clearly what I was doing and why I did that and why it was the right move. But in that moment, it felt very uncertain and it was a leap of faith. And, you know, basically what I was, my faith moment was not believing in a religion or a spirituality or something, you know, bigger than me. It was simply just believing in myself, believing that what I was feeling and what instincts I had were genuine and authentic and I should follow them despite all evidence to the contrary. Like it was a really bold risk to quit my job and to make enough money for that plane ticket. I actually had to get a job as a waiter in the evenings on top of my day job. And so there was quite a bit of soul searching, but ultimately I just was like, you know what? I'm feeling this. I'm going to do it. And that I think was, you know, like the shift from feeling crappy about myself, from feeling like I was just living a sort of a 9-to-5. There's a quote from poetry. I think it's from T.S. Eliot, but it's, what is it? A 9-to-5 daily death or something. But it's this idea that I was just sort of dying every day.
Spooning out your life in spoonfuls, I think. Is that what you're talking about? No? Yeah.
And then when I started thinking about this idea of going to South America, I felt this like new energy and I just kind of followed that. I grabbed onto that thread of energy and I just kept following it, to where I am today.
And how did the adventure in Chile lead to an obsession to improve education in the United States?
Well, you know, what I realized about myself in retrospect now, and this gets into the work on purpose that I do today with adults and with children, is that I realized that I'm a path forger. I'm someone who likes making paths, who likes bringing others along in these new paths. And, you know, as a journalist, when I went to South America, one of the things I loved doing was breaking stories, but also getting other media outlets to write about the story and sort of like almost like build a movement around the story. And the problem with South America, and I ended up spending 6 years down there, is that I spent my time focused on very difficult problems like climate change, human rights, I wrote, my last big story was a piece for Mother Jones about how the workers in rose plantations in Ecuador were essentially being poisoned in order to, you know, poisoned by the herbicides and the pesticides they were using in order to export flowers to the United States. And so it felt very negative. And the reason I stopped being a journalist is that I wanted to stop focusing on problems and instead focus on solutions. And that led me straight to education as a very powerful platform for helping build students of purpose.
Before we move into your education work, what have you developed any philosophies yourself about how transformation happens? I mean, when you look back on the whole experience of leaving your job, going on the adventure in South America, coming back, leaning into your new purpose, what comes up when I ask, how does transformation happen?
Well, you know, I believe that what I have seen very clearly is that we can either go with the system and let ourselves be dominated by the system, which can feel, we know from studies that only about 40% of adults today report high levels of meaning and purpose in their life. So 60% of adults are sort of going with the flow, essentially. And the other option is to take control of our lives. And I think of this as purpose, right? It's about having faith that we are unique humans who have a gift. I think, you know, just looking at your thumbprint alone, you'll see that your thumbprint is unique. No one has it. Not even identical twins share the same thumbprint, mm-hmm. right? And so it's having faith that we each have a gift to bring to the world, and then following it and really following that gift to its logical extension. I mean, I think there's forking paths in life, and you know, that was my big forking path. And you know, my work with schools is helping us help kids see those forking paths in high school, even, right? And not have to get to like their early 20s, even like I did, or even worse, you know, we all know David Brooks, who's the New York Times op-ed columnist, but David Brooks has a book that he's written this year called The Second Mountain. Mm. And, you know, I enjoyed reading the book, but I completely disagree with its premise. And the premise of this book is that many humans live two mountains. The first mountain is a mountain of achievement, where we, you know, go after achievement, and you know, sometimes it's building a company or getting a job or whatever. And you can think of my work as a reporter as I was heading up that mountain of achievement, you know, going towards the Washington Post. But David Brooks says that, you know, many adults reach the top of that first mountain and find the summit very unsatisfying and meaningless. And so they descend from that mountain after being very successful, walk into this valley of despair and whatever, and then climb a second mountain of fulfillment, right? Which mm-hmm. is where they find kind of like the second calling in life. And my point is, we should teach kids to climb the second mountain the first time and not climb two mountains at all, but just climb one, right? And that's the premise of my work.
Let's go deeper into that. I love that. I mean, I know that what you're saying actually kind of contradicts even what thinkers like Carl Jung would say, that there is this false self that gets developed in our early years. And I love this idea of how do you push through and climb the second mountain first. Talk to me about how that's done. I mean, so you've been working on a book, I know, called Deep and Bright and Deep.
Yeah.
And talk about Bright and Deep, the concept.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's based on science and research that's happened primarily over the last 20 years, thanks to positive psychology, which is a growing movement of neuroscientists and behavioral scientists and all kinds of medical researchers who are researching this question. You know, if traditional psychology focuses on the dysfunctions of humans, the anxieties and the neuroses, et cetera, positive psychology focuses on what makes human beings thrive, what makes them happy, what helps them find meaning and purpose in life. And scientists have now a working definition of purpose, which is, you know, the definition used by scientists at Stanford's Center on Adolescence is a stable intention that is meaningful to self and beneficial to the world. So to break that down, purpose is stable. It doesn't typically change in our lifetime. And it's something that is meaningful to self. So it's meaning on the inside that is also beneficial to the world. So it's an action we take that benefits someone or something outside of ourselves. So it's really very simple. It is a thread that moves through our life. It is the gift or the meaning that we have on the inside and how we use that to take action in benefit of something or someone on the outside. And that's what purpose is. And, you know, scientists know how to measure it. Stanford has developed a youth purpose study, which is an instrument to study purposefulness in youth. And only about 20% of high school students have a sense of purpose. The other sort of types of students are there's goal-driven students who are very focused on action and getting it done, but it's not really anchored in any deeper meaning. There's a similar group of students that we call dreamers, who are students that have a lot of meaning and identity on the inside, but still haven't really found a way to make it happen in their school or their life. And then there's this fourth category called the disengaged, which are students that have neither dreams and meaning on the inside or action on the outside. And so they're just disengaged. And, you know, roughly high school divides into these like four quadrants. And so, you know, another way to understand the work that I'm trying to do is to take that 20% of purpose-driven kids and expand it to like 50% or more, right? And really allow students to use high school as a platform and, you know, K through 12 in general to explore who they are on the inside and then how they can use those gifts to take action on the outside.
I've been reading some lately about, dominant narratives and other narratives and cross narratives. I guess what I'm going with this is, you know, it's tough to listen to your inner voice when it is not in alignment with the dominant narrative. What I'm talking about is, you know, this narrative in America to, you know, to achieve financial success and sometimes your purpose might not be aligned with the traditional path to mortgage, home, family, those kinds of things.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think there's so many things that having a clear sense of purpose and not only having a clear sense of it, but having it in words, having a statement, having language that we can rely on. You know, my purpose statement that I developed a decade ago and have lived with for a decade is I forge paths so that goodness prevails. Mm. So I'm a path forger. I have to be forging paths to be happy. And I'm all about making sure the good people win, right? That's everything I do, you know, is focused on that. And that purpose statement is really important for, you know, for like three main ways. The first way is that it helps me tell a stable narrative about my past. I understand why now I love to explore paths in the woods as a child. I understand why I love to build movements around stories as a journalist. I also understand why I had to stop working on problems all the time. And now I really understand why I was successful at starting World Leadership School, because I am good at forging paths and then, you know, with this idea of creating goodness. So it's really useful to help us like organize and build stories about our past. It's also a really powerful way to look into the future and decide what we should be doing and what we should not be doing. You know, I don't know what I'll be doing in 10 years, but I have to be forging paths. And then the final thing, the third thing is that it really helps us combat dominant narratives and racial stereotypes and negative narratives that are out there. Because you're right. I mean, you know, with my father, who's really was part of the old system, what I think of as like standardization, right? This idea that, you know, you just have to sort of move the straight line and commit to a big company and stay the course and not take any risks. And if you work hard, you'll be happy. Like that's the old narrative, right? And my father was sort of voicing that narrative to me. And, you know, that narrative did work in the 20th century. I'm not so sure it works anymore, though. I was really interested recently to see Amanda Morgan, obviously America's Youth Poet Laureate, speak at Biden's inauguration. And, you know, she represents that, like, that deep and bright quality that we talk about with purpose-driven students. Deep meaning her brain is thoroughly connected to her emotions. She's just one, you can just sense her deepness that way, and her brightness. Like, you can just sense how connected she is to the world, to things happening around her. And one of the interesting, really interesting things I read about Amanda Morgan after that is that she has a purpose statement that she reads before every public speaking engagement she gives. You know, she has a pretty serious speech impediment and some processing, auditory processing issues that she struggled with her entire life. And this is what, I'm going to just read this because it's so cool. This is a mantra that she recites before every speaking engagement. And it's, quote, "I am the daughter of Black writers. We are descended from freedom fighters who broke their chains and changed the world. They call me." So, you know, she basically, and I do the same thing with my purpose statement. I'm like, when I'm nervous getting up on a stage, I'm like, I'm a path forger. You know, I forge paths so that goodness prevails. It's a powerful, I mean, this kind of practice is at the heart of some very compelling performance and equity focused research. You know, when we know who we are and what matters to us, we better overcome negative stories and pressures against us.
So how do we teach kids to listen to their purpose, to develop their purpose develop or listen to or cultivate it maybe, and be able to turn away from some of the pulls and that the dominant narrative might be asking of them to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And there's some simple techniques, and then there's some much deeper and harder techniques. On the simple side, and I say simple because they are something that everyone can access and take a relatively short amount of time. But we have developed at World Leadership School these experiences called Youth Purpose Summits, which are 3-day events for students where we bring diverse students from all these different schools together. We're doing this also in online environments. And students do an activity called calling cards, which is all about discovering their gifts. They learn about purpose. They learn that it's a thing. They learn that it's something that we can all work to clarify for ourselves. They create these life maps, which are like these maps of their life so far. And they plot what we call groove moments, which are moments of like, yes, this is exactly who I'm meant to be. And also growth moments, moments where we stumbled, maybe had a setback and we learned something. Mm-hmm. They get into pairs and they share stories, and their listening partner helps them like see a pattern in their story. They put that together into a purpose statement. And then the final step is they build maps around their purpose statements, which include things like, what are my identities? What's my privilege? Who are the people I need to surround myself with? What are some daily practices I'm going to follow to keep my energy and creativity alive? We also ask them to inventory how they spend their time and energy. So, you know, in order to figure out like how they can live more of their day on purpose. And so by the end of this 3-day experience, and it's about 3 hours a day, they walk away with this purpose map. And, you know, we like to embed this purpose map into advisory programs in schools, like their kind of social emotional learning programs in schools, so that advisors can keep working with the students and keep them on track with their maps, like their practices and their sounding boards and their purpose goals, all these things. You know, purpose, like the purpose statement is not like a blinding flash of insight. It's not like, oh my God, I just discovered who I am. It's more like a reliable signpost that's pointing you in one direction. And we need like all the follow-on work, the discipline work, the daily practice work, to help kids like make a little bit of progress each day in that direction.
Right. Do you work with adults as well?
Yes, I do. In fact, that's how I learned about this work. You know, I started another company, which I sold, which was really focused on helping corporations integrate social innovation. And you know, in that work, I got to work alongside this executive coach named Richard Leiter, who is in his almost his late 70s, and he's an amazing executive coach. But for 7 or 8 years, Richard and I and other coaches worked with leaders from Ericsson, which is a Swedish technology company. We would take these leaders to Africa, to Tanzania, and would put them through like this week-long purpose boot camp. So, you know, corporations have done a really good job using positive psychology and the science of purpose to develop purpose-driven leaders who are like really effective at leading and creating profits. And, you know, my work is just now bringing this work to schools. I mean, why don't we do this work with teenagers? Mm-hmm. It's the same. We're preparing these kids for the same volatile, uncertain future.
Right. How is it different working with somebody, say, in middle age that realizes, you know, after ascending the first mountain of success and you know, the usual you know, trappings of contemporary, you know, American life and finds that unfulfilling and wants to go deeper into their purpose? Can you talk a little bit about how you would work with somebody like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's really two really interesting purpose moments. One happens young in life when you're in your teen years and your 20s. And the other happens, I think, after that, you know, first unfortunate mountain that Brooks talks about. And for some people, you know, like for my dad, for instance, that mountain happened when he was like in his mid-50s. I have some friends who are retiring earlier than that. Most people retire in their mid-60s, some people, you know. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of depends. But what I do know is that what's not satisfying is working with people who are still climbing that first mountain. Mm-hmm. And that was my experience working with the executives at the Fortune 50 company, that, you know, these people were in their early 40s, late 30s. They were working really hard. They're very focused on performance targets that were very clear in front of them. They might take a few days in Tanzania to think about their purpose, but, you know, as soon as they get back to their jobs, they're off and running again. It's really very hard. When you're on your ascent to that first mountain, it's very hard to stop people and have them like retreat to base camp again. I mean, at that point, they're going to the summit. Yeah. And, you know, that's why it wasn't really, I mean, I found about 30% of the adults I worked with had coachable purpose, in that scenario with young corporate executives. And when I work with teachers, I find, and I'm not exaggerating, 100%, every teacher I've ever worked with, and I've now worked with thousands of teachers, every single teacher I've ever worked with has a sense of coachable purpose. You know, teachers get into teaching for that because they're called for it. And
right.
The problem is they don't really understand why they're there. And this year has been so bruising that a lot of them are questioning like everything. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really important time to help teachers reconnect with why they got into teaching.
Is this distinction between executives and teachers something that's built into our personalities at a young, maybe how we come into the world, or is it more something developed over time, or both? And what was your understanding of why there's such a wide discrepancy?
You know, that's a great question that I honestly don't have a good answer to. Uh-huh. And, you know, I am not proposing that by the end of high school or the end of college, we could get every student to pursue a life of meaning. Mm-hmm. But I do think we can do a lot better than 20%. And I do think we can get to 50%. And that would make a huge difference for classrooms, for school communities, and frankly, for our planet. Because, you know, purpose-driven people naturally create benefit for others and other things. I mean, that's just, you can't be purpose-driven and not do that. And so it's a really good, it's good for humans, and it's also good for our planet. And that other 50% that is either a dreamer or goal-driven or disengaged, I don't know why that happens. Is it because of their upbringing? Is it because of their cognitive makeup? Is it because they lacked opportunities, critical education opportunities, or mentors? You know, I'm not really
right. Sure. Yeah. I guess I'm wondering too with the, about maybe the word intuition, you know, and it seems to me that getting aligned with one's purpose is somehow requires us to connect with our intuition. And yet I don't really completely understand that concept. Is that something that you've looked at or developed an understanding about?
That's an interesting question. You know, what I have learned about helping people discover their purpose is that it's not something we can do on our own. It really is. The most important piece is to be part of a community that is affirming and supportive. And so whether it's your friend group or hopefully your school or your workplace, like being part of a supportive community is really important. And then the second sort of like fallacy, I think, of purpose work, or a fallacy of purpose work, is that people think that by reflecting or even meditating, like we can see our purpose. I think our purpose comes through most clearly when we tell stories and when we actually turn our thinking brain off and we dive into stories that matter and we become vulnerable. And that's why this golden thread exercise I was mentioning is so critical. That, you know, it's done in pairs, and essentially one person, you know, it's a very confidential experience, highly coached, highly curated, where, you know, one person is sharing very vulnerable stories about their life and the other person is looking for patterns and they're coaching. And what we see almost every time we do this is that you cannot see your own patterns in your own life. Like you can just tell the stories and then other people can like see those patterns and help you see them. And so, you know, I mean, kind of like the enemy of purpose clarification is a lot of thinking and reflection. I think it comes through emotion and storytelling and working with people who we trust that can help us see things about ourselves that we can't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really an interesting process, actually.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I'm hearing and what I've read from of your upcoming book is that there's this forging a connection between head and heart and as you would say in hands as well, but the head heart part, is fascinating. And I think, you know, we live in this, we seem to be increasingly emphasizing logic and the way we educate people and in the way we, our society thinks it functions. And yet I think from what I've read that the emotion is something that is never disconnected from our sense of logic, and it's sort of a fallacy that the two things are even different. I think there's a famous Justice Potter Stewart? I can't remember, but said something like, people think we make decisions based on the facts and the law, and in fact, we make decisions based on emotion, and then we justify our decisions logically, which I think is an incredible quote from a Supreme Court justice. But how do you teach people to connect their heart and their head?
Well, that's a great question. And I mean, it's like neuroscience is very clear on this, that our emotional brains, you think of like your part of your brain that's right on your top of your spinal column, that's your limbic brain, right? That's our emotional primitive brain, thinks very, very quickly. It's not really that great with words. That's where all of our intuition and behavior, frankly, comes from. And then we have our modern brain, our cerebral frontal cortex, which is that part in our, you know, sort of behind our forehead. That's our modern brain, our slow brain, the brain that is. And, you know, what neuroscientists like Helen Imerdino Yang at the University of Southern California, you know, she's continued like 30 years now of research on this, that, you know, one of the things she says is we only learn about what we care about. And what she means is that, you know, they've done scans of kids doing like rote learning, like very simple, like memorizing content or filling in the blanks or taking a standardized test. And she sees only that the part of the brain that's activated is only that frontal cortex, right? But when she gives students a chance to like tell a story that feels meaningful or, you know, engage in some learning that really feels connected to that person's sense of identity, then you see the whole brain light up all the way, you know, the frontal cortex engages with the limbic. And when emotions come into play, that's when we store complex memories. That's when we do complex, you know, capable of very complex cognitive tasks. That's basically when deep learning happens. And that's what that judge is saying. You know, it's like, you know, when those justices are making those decisions, they're using their full brains. They may be using their frontal cortex primarily to write the, you know, the decision afterwards, but it's a whole brain exercise.
Right. You know, when I extrapolate out from the work you do in imagining a society where kids are more connected with their sense of purpose as they graduate and move into the workforce, I see the possibility of transforming society, I guess. So the implications of it seem pretty big. I was recently, I recently read a book called Woke by an anesthesiologist named Madhava Sethi, I think. And he's developed his ideas that really run counter to how we even think about consciousness now. And I'll just try to give it a thumbnail here. But from his experience as an anesthesiologist, he's come to believe with evidence, he says, that the consciousness cannot emerge from material, from the body, that must exist outside the body, which is a radical idea. I mean, it's something that in spiritual circles has been around a long time, but to have it come from a physician and a scientist is mind-blowing. But the implications of how that would change how we think about our lives is massive. But I guess I'm just imagining, you know, thousands of people graduating and following their intuition and turning their backs in somewhat degree on the dominant narrative and what society might look like. What does that bring up for you?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think it's the only way our planet will survive if we activate our uniquely human ability to tell story, make meaning, follow paths, give back to a collective. You know, I think this work of purpose is really important. And, you know, I think that what's encouraging is you look at the workplace today, and the workplace is very different from it was when I graduated college in the mid-1980s. You know, when I graduated college, it was like the idea was, you know, you do really well with your grades, you do these on-campus interviews, and then you go off and work for like Lehman Brothers or JP Morgan or Coca-Cola. You sort of like join this corporation. It's a very straight path. If it gets tough, you know, just stay the course, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the message of that error, which I call the error of standardization, was, you know, hey, if you work really hard, you'll be happy. And to me, the new workplace is very, very different. Like, I'm now interviewing, hiring people all the time. And what I look for is I don't so much care. Like, what I'm looking for is engagement. I want people who are like fully alive, who are interested, who ask great questions. Like, I'm really interested in like almost like their energy. Right. And
right.
You can't fake that. You can't fake that at all.
And I think what you're telling me is you can see students even at a young age with this deep and bright look in their eyes, and you can almost identify them by looking at them, which ones are deeply connected to their purpose. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I think that, you know, like I've got two kids in high school and middle school, and, you know, what I'm constantly trying to look for is sparks. Like, where do they, like, I think I have a good sense of who they are and how they're different, but I'm also looking for, like, what are those things they can do that help them really sort of come alive with energy and with wonder? Like, that to me is much more important than the grades. Like, look, I know they have to get good grades. I know they have to take the AP exams, the SATs, et cetera. I know that's important for the Courage College admissions process. But I think increasingly this new system, which I call personalization, it's like, it's asking us, like, what's your story? You know, how do you connect to things, right? And if you look at the latest generation of essay prompts for the Common Application, which is now the application that everyone uses now to apply for college, you know, there are questions that are very similar to our golden thread exercise. The questions like, one of the essay prompts is, some students have a background that is so meaningful to them that their college application would be incomplete without it. If this applies to you, what's your story, right? Mm. That's a question that you and I never had to answer
right.
when we applied to college 30 years ago or whatever it was, 25 years ago. And you know, another question now that asks actually for a greater level of vulnerability is, some students have experienced a setback, hardship, or suffering that has led them to grow. You know, if this applies to you, what's your story, right? And so these are the sorts of questions now that college admissions officers are really interested in. They know that these kids that have a sense of purpose will be much better students ultimately. You know, colleges are facing, we haven't talked about this, but colleges are facing, and high schools too, the largest mental health crisis in youth we have ever seen. Mm. 1 in 3 18-year-olds today qualifies for an anxiety disorder. Suicide rates have increased by 60% just in the last year during COVID, and we're already at an all-time high. We know from positive psychology research that having a sense of purpose helps students manage stress, helps them connect emotion to learning and learn deeper. It helps adults live longer, heal faster, sleep better. Like meaning is like one of the biggest things we can do as humans to live a healthy life.
You mentioned that the pandemic has had a big effect on teachers and education as a whole. You know, since you are an innovative thinker, what other effects, positive or negative, do you think the pandemic will have for our society?
Oh, I think it could be huge, depending on how we respond. And I know for schools, I mean, my expertise really is with schools. But you know, everything about, you know, a year ago, people would say, oh, it takes, you know, 5 years to get anything done in a school. COVID disproved all of that. We now know that schools can change in a matter of weeks if they have to. They can change schedules, they can change curriculum, they can change learning platform, they can change everything. And the amount of innovation that came out of schools, as painful as it was for teachers, and it came at a great emotional cost for teachers who were really frontline workers in the largest disruption ever in the history of school, and they were traumatized by it. Many teachers were deeply traumatized. But, you know, it's brought us to this turning point where, you know, we've seen the University of California and other major university systems have basically said they're no longer going to take the SATs. They're no longer going to require the SAT or the ACT in their college admissions process. So, like, the standardized tests took a huge blow. Most school districts are not giving their normal state standardized testing this spring. So it's, you know, there's been some really big changes in schools. And now the question that all schools are trying to ask is, okay, what innovation do we want to, what things about the past do we want to leave behind forever? And what new innovations do we want to bring forward? So it's an exciting moment of like re-envisioning in schools.
When you look back now on all your work and as well as your time in Chile, you know, I guess I'm kind of moving towards this, a discussion about wisdom and, you know, what does that word fit into your work? I guess I want to know first, what is wisdom and is that something connected to purpose?
Yeah, I think it absolutely is connected to purpose. I think it absolutely is connected to purpose. And, you know, I think of Socrates sort of commandment to know thyself, right? And I think the deepest kind of wisdom comes from knowing, you know, we're all an experiment of one. We're all amazingly unique. So it's really knowing, you know, who we are and how we can bring our gifts to the world. And then really like creating that putting a stake in the ground and saying, this is it, this is who I am, and unifying our past around it, projecting forward into the future, combating these negative stories that society and others tell about us, and moving forward in a very stable and reliable way. And, you know, if you, you know, purpose is not a, it's not a revolution. It's not a sort of a mountaintop revelation. It is like slow daily work, right, in a single direction. Mm-hmm. And by doing that daily work, it becomes more and more powerful. So like I'm, you know, after 10 years or 15 years of doing this work now, I'm much better at it than I used to be. And I have a much firmer sense of myself than I used to have. That I think is really the ultimate wisdom, is to make a story about oneself and then follow it, right? And there's some really compelling psychiatric research around this. You know, you may have heard of the technique narrative therapy, which is a psychiatric technique that originated actually in New Zealand in the 1970s and has really become sort of a mainstay practice now. But it's this idea that, you know, all of us we all have negative self-talk. Mm-hmm. And some of us have limiting self-beliefs and limiting stories about ourselves. And we do that because we, you know, take moments of our past lives and we connect them into like this negative storyline, right? And right. For instance, I was a stutterer. I kind of kept my head down. And so my storyline was maybe my voice doesn't matter, right? Right. And what I've realized now with more living and, you know, that actually I do keep my head down. I am sort of behind the scenes, but I see things that other people do. I see possibilities that other people don't. I mm-hmm. forge these paths. And I'm really fighting for goodness. And so it's this like new storyline like that I'm creating. Like I'm not this silent person whose voice doesn't matter. I am actually someone who sees possibilities and forges paths, right? It's a very positive, it's a very powerful thing to do that, to like rewrite one's story. And on a therapeutic level, that's really what the work of clarifying purpose is all about.
It seems to me so often, and you seem to be hinting at this, is maybe finding our strength and maybe purpose is connected with maybe moving into a weakness. I mean, what I guess it was when you saw, you know, when you moved closer to the stuttering and how it affected you, you maybe found the silver lining of the importance of your voice. Is that making sense? What I'm asking? There's a connection between. Go ahead. Yeah.
I wouldn't call it weakness, but I would call it vulnerability. You know, like when I was making my decision to go to Chile, you know, I mean, I didn't have any argument to stand on. I couldn't say, well, I know Spanish or I have experience doing this or I have a job or, you know, I had to move into this like very like foggy, like place in my person. That was just really nothing more than a gut instinct. And I just had to, you know, and so it's not about moving into a weakness. I think it's about moving into like a vulnerable space and feeling confident enough to live from that space.
Right. Well, I want to circle back and end with this, my question about wisdom, because as I was thinking about your answer, I realized that imagining a society where more people had lived their purpose, including then aging into being elders, and being able to share their wisdom from a life of living in their purpose. Imagine, you know, 50 or 60 or 70% of the population that had lived a life of purpose and then is able to look back and teach from that life. Seems powerful as a transformative idea.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, I think purpose breeds more purpose. You're absolutely mm-hmm. right about that. And yes. I hadn't even thought about that, but that's very, very true. I mean, you know, my own dad, you know, he had so many gifts and he was such a remarkable man. I mean, he passed away a decade ago But you know what I saw in his last couple decades of life is that he never, like, he had this very successful, like, first mountain business career. And I just feel like when you climb that first mountain so hard, for many people, it's hard to find the energy and the ideas and the inspiration to, like, climb that second mountain. I mean, the second mountain takes a heck of a lot of energy. And so it's, I kind of look back on the last couple of decades of my dad's life as, with a little sadness, you know, that he didn't kind of figure it out, because he had such tremendous gifts. Mm-hmm. And he led, you're absolutely right. I mean, an elder who's lived a full life of meaning, oh boy, they have a lot of power to help others, help others do the same.
Yeah. Well, Ross, I really want to thank you for sitting with me today and talking about purpose and talking about education and transformation. And I've learned a lot, and thank you so much.
Absolutely, Brad. It was a total pleasure.
Thank you, Ross. So how did that land on you? How did Ross's explanation of how we can find our purpose and how he helps others find their purpose land on you? And did you come away with it feeling any clearer about maybe how to move forward in your own life? You know, I think it really helped me, that conversation, almost picture this place inside me where my head, heart, and hands come together. You know, he talked so much about when students are in alignment with how they think, how they feel, and what they do better in school. And they leave school after graduation more focused and more able to step into the earlier years of their life. You know, so many of us, I think, run on messages from parents and culture in our early years of our life about who we're supposed to be. And sometimes we find ourselves having found that person that we thought we were supposed to be in midlife, only to discover that it wasn't very fulfilling and that who we now are isn't who we want to be and maybe isn't who we are. So I hope you'll listen to Ross again if it works for you to go deeper into finding your own purpose. And, you know, I guess I'm just left to end with today. I'm grateful for my own spiritual practices and psychological mindset work that I've done and do continually to stay present to myself. You know, I think that training your mind, training your heart to be more open, and training your hands to do things that you want to do, it's all trainable. And I think that's the incredible thing that the ancient, you know, yogis, you know, the Buddhist masters, all the spiritual, you know, big beings that laid down these paths for us, whatever it is for you, they do help us to get clear in our head, open space in our hearts. And when we do that, we can move into the world in a more aligned way that makes others feel safe around us, perhaps, and also helps us continue to grow, because we're all on a journey to become whole. And I think it never ends, really. It's a journey that never ends. But those of us who are on that journey find a lot of sense of purpose and meaning in our lives. And, well, I'll leave you with that. I'm grateful to be here. I hope this next year, as we turn the corner on the pandemic and move past this one-year anniversary of it, I hope things begin to open up more. And I hope you found the last year useful in some way, even if it was hard. Useful in understanding yourself a bit more, and maybe you changed. And I would love to hear how you changed. So drop me a note. Talk to me about how you changed during the pandemic. And I'd love to share some of these notes on my next podcast. So stay safe, stay well, stay on the path. I'm Brad Wetzler. Goodbye.